Welcome to the commentary track. The 20th Century Fox logo is coming up right now. My name is Nick Nunziata. You may know me from Chud.com. I'm also a very big fan of the film Tekken. And I think possibly the reason we're doing this commentary track is as Tekken 2 comes out this weekend, they wanted some professionals to talk about the movie. My involvement in the film is tangential at best. I wrote, directed, and starred in the film. Alongside of me...
Hi, my name is Ren Brown. You may also know me from Chud.com and SquirrelPorn.org. And few people know I actually worked on this film. I was the technician in charge of Squibs exclusively for...
We have
We have
a special guest with us who I will be reaching to from time to time as little as possible. Andrew Hawkins, tell us about yourself.
Yes, my name is Andrew Hawkins. I'm a technician journeyman, and I have seen Fist of the North Star.
Excellent.
Brown people.
Tekken
many.
Was the...
Squibs for brown people.
Now, as we watch this film, we see Liam Neeson's character, a typical action hero named Brian, who is in his home. The very soft lighting here by director Pierre Morel. Pierre Morel, you may know from his other works. I personally know him because he worked at the Chocolate Factory. His style is very raw. Working with Luc Besson, that's the kind of shit that Frenchman likes. Luc Besson is very famous sellout. He worked exclusively in France until he didn't. This scene shows Liam Neeson entering a pawn shop where a taxi cab driver is behind the counter. And they are looking at items. This is the infamous karaoke purchase scene. This man, you may know him. He played alongside Aziz Ansari, I believe his name is, in every role.
Absolutely. And this scene is really notable. A lot has been written about the subtext of this particular purchase and what it suggests for American and European relations, that kind of thing. Also, just because the karaoke machine is sexy as hell.
Yeah, well, Liam Neeson, like, he studied with gift wrappers for 2 weeks to prepare for this scene. And he became so adept at it, Barnes & Noble hires him in the holiday season.
Yeah, he really put the time in the trenches at Macy's. Yeah. And it was right during holiday season, so I know he really roughed it out.
Yeah, they did a take of this scene where he carries a pink elephant. They figured a few fans of Darkman would take umbrage with that, so they pulled it away. Introduced here is Famke Janssen as his ex-wife, a very beautiful woman, probably best known for being Michael Douglas's injured wife in that movie where his wife's injured.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, Mr. Hawkins, this is the first time I'm going to reach out to you. Tell me about the first time, concisely, tell me about the first time you saw Tekken.
Well, the first time I saw Tekken, I was taken aback about how this was just a film regarding a normal, everyday man who goes through all kinds of struggle and difficulty to really find himself and his family and reconnect with what he values most. And I think it's a great film for our time.
Maggie Grace plays his daughter. Maggie Grace is famous from Lost and from Grace Under Fire. She's a young up-and-coming actress who was hired by Pierre Morel sight unseen. He's blind.
Yeah. He's also deaf, which is why someone who sounds so much like a vulture is.
And here's the reason why this film was given a budget. Xander Berkeley agreed to star in the film in a supporting role, but the financiers did not know this, of course, and instantly greenlit the film based on his involvement. Also, Seabiscuit, also in the film. Most folks thought that Seabiscuit died back in the early days. Seabiscuit continues. Not cast in the film Seabiscuit, but a runner-up for the role of Warhorse. We'll be talking a lot about this horse over the course of this commentary track because there's a lot of subtext, Kubrickian subtext, in which this horse is objectified in various ways throughout the plot.
Of course. Horses in Morel's filmography obviously, you know, play a big role. They're a repeating image. And this one has another goddamn horse. So
yeah,
we got to get into that.
The role was originally given to Hilary Swank. There was a conflict. She got pregnant and had a fantastic young mare. Liam Neeson's character, Brian, which is not a good name for an action star.
No, it really underplays the everyman quality of this guy who's going to kick a lot of cock into people.
Yeah.
And, you know, Brian kind of, it makes you think maybe that's not going to happen. Maybe the trailers lied to you. Maybe he's just going to sit and look at pictures and weep.
Well, I think a similar problem came up during the early days of AC/DC. Like, you can't have a guy named Brian in the band. And look what they've done. They've succeeded. Here is the introduction of some amazing character actors: Leland Orser, John Grise, and that guy from Running Scared. Liam Neeson's character, Brian, enters Tekken as a retired badass. He and his group of men played very, very well here by these actors. You could see the history between them. John Grise, obviously famous for Fright Night, famous for Napoleon Dynamite, and famous for the saying, "Do you want Grise with that?" These guys, there's a backstory here that Pierre Morel wanted to shoot. In fact, he wanted this Tekken to be the last film in a 12-part trilogy.
Oh, yeah, he was going to reverse engineer an entire saga.
Yeah, because, I mean, Maggie Grace gets you in the door, but what he really wanted to do was focus on these amazing men, these characters who have obviously fought together, bled together, lost lives together.
Also, this scene was originally shot entirely in the nude. And then kind of an unacknowledged commentary on homoeroticism and masculinity, but American audiences shrunk at the sight.
Yeah, and of course it's reproducing the age-old action hero cliche of a barbecue sequence. Famous, if you remember the scene in First Blood, when inexplicably in the middle of the police station, a barbecue breaks out. A good portion of Schindler's List was a barbecue, at least to some. And obviously, John Grise, Napoleon Dynamite, the famous barbecue drawing sequence. This actor here holding the beer was in Running Scared, the film by Wayne Kramer, and he played a jerk. And how he channeled his personal life into this particular role is he for 2 weeks, he spent at a barbecue and watched Darkman. Unfortunately, he was very disappointed to arrive on the set and realize that this is not the Jeff Fahey Darkman. Mr. Hawkins, I'm going to go back to you. Leland Orser is a beloved character actor from Seven and from one of the Alien films. And recently, he died in an episode of Magic City.
He did.
He really did. How important do you, as a scholar, find it that a film like this fills the margins with fantastic character actors like Leland Orser and the Horse?
Well, when it comes to Leland Orser and the Horse and the others, it's definitely a film like Alien where you're really connecting with the...
Hold on, this is the skyline. This is a helicopter shot. All right, we're back.
One thing I'd like to note is that John Grise is actually reprising his role from Terror Vision. Now, we see him die in the original film, but he's been reincarnated, put back into this situation, and it just rolls with it.
Now, this scene is very reminiscent of The Bodyguard, and they were going to use Whitney Houston had she remembered how to swim.
Indeed. There's a lot of cultural commentary. Again, we're digging into some really deep subtextual issues about cultural cunts.
Yeah. See, the girl who plays this this rock star, she's not famous, but only because she's unattractive and not talented.
Exactly, which was a keen choice.
Yeah.
Very subtle.
Now, the idea being that when hard men retire from their hard business, they go into a world of bodyguards and bouncers and somewhat substandard careers where people don't give them the respect they've earned. Along the same lines is this girl right here. She was discovered while Pierre Morel was urinating. He was in a stall, and she had been passed out directly underneath his genitals. And he knew. He's like, this is like one of those moments. This is going to be on the IMDb trivia page, found under my balls. And, you know, it's funny. In some languages, the transcription of this film, when they watch the subtitles, her name is under the balls, not Shira. This scene here is all build up. This is the life Liam Neeson has grown accustomed to. He's divorced, he's put everything he had into his wife, and now he lives a life where these little fleeting moments of contact with his loved daughter really keep him going. Absolutely. It's obvious that that this means something to Liam Neeson, having just lost his wife. This was his way to take that tragic moment and turn it into something. Obviously, it led to a career resurgence. Liam Neeson action figure sales are up. stuffed animals sales have gone up. His number is the most number one piece of Taken merchandise.
I believe you mean Tekken.
I do. I think it's great. It's great. This saved his career. It saved his career right here. And look at the smile. I mean, like, an Irishman doesn't smile. That's, like, one of the policies. But Liam Neeson really sells it right there. He's a good actor. Also has
uncomfortable territory.
He has a huge penis as well.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
I think this is the happiest we've actually seen him since Krull, I believe.
Yes, and his banker as well. Now here we're really setting up, because this in a traditional studio film, this would have been cut out immediately, because Leland Orser's in it, but also because this is a movie about a daughter being kidnapped and then a man rescuing her. And I didn't mean to provide a spoiler. That's what happens. Now here's the attack. Look at how quickly Brian dispenses justice.
Not get to be this kind of a badass without real training and commitment to your craft.
Which is mostly came at the hand of Master Yoda. And all the Jedi techniques that they've set up in every film are evident in this sidequel.
Now this stuff here, this is kind of fat. So while this is happening, we'll talk a little bit about how Tekken came to be. Originally, his character's name was Terry. They had to change that because there was another action film coming out with a guy named Terry. And then Little Pete. Obviously the Little Pete franchise is kind of just getting off the ground now with John McTiernan.
Yeah, and the Little Pete drafts of Tekken are some of the most sought-after, rare scripts in Hollywood. But if you ever can get a hold of one of those, they're great to read. I mean, obviously this is a masterpiece, what came to be. But to go back and see what was originally planned with the catacomb chase and the mummy sequences, all of those things, you really should give it a shot.
Yeah, it's funny. Liam Neeson kind of was in a dark place when this came to be, and he initially came to set up a question here. He felt that was part of his character's motivation. He also
They shot a few scenes that way before they...
They did. Those may be on the DVD. Keep in mind, this is the extended version of the film that we're watching here.
Right.
So those sequences may have been reinserted since I downloaded it on iTunes. But the other thing to keep in mind was another one of his stylistic decisions was he did not want to use a vehicle in the entire film. Which is weird because there's a car chase, there's a scene on a boat...
Right.
He had a very strict no-vehicle policy. He wanted everything to happen when he clicks his shoes.
Absolutely.
So he wanted to have a fight scene to the death where he's clicking his heels the whole time and teleporting him and his assailant all across the galaxy.
And this is also a time when he was struggling very hard to pitch a version of the script which had Orson Welles as himself appearing as kind of a ghost of sorts, a guide that would point him in the correct direction when he couldn't figure out what door to open, these kinds of things. They worked very hard, spent supposedly around $20 million on the previs and effects development, and it just did not work out.
Speaking of previs, that shake looks like pre-jizz. Now, this divorced couple stuff, originally Pierre Morel wanted this to be kind of an extended universe sequel to Kramer versus Kramer. This is what could have happened. Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep could have broken up and then he gone and fought terrorists.
Of course.
So that was kind of like when they were on the set, they had a laugh about that because obviously Tekken and Kramer versus Kramer featured different stars, but there's still that neat extended universe element to it. Now here Famke is representing one's ego. The battle that he is facing between his desire to literally have sex with his daughter and his ability to feed her. He's got that paternal thing going on, but Famke represents what's right, and he knows something's wrong, but he wants something right. But even though she's bringing something wrong, there's always that want-to-be-right going on.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. This is one of those scenes where you can actually, most of what you're seeing is CGI effects, because the day that this particular sequence was shot, they actually forgot the camera at Morel's house where he had been using it the night before for some of his activities. So they shot it entirely on a Game Boy camera, which obviously the resolution is not very high, it's not in color, so a lot of this is augmented effects, and you'll see that a few times throughout the movie. You have to look pretty hard to find it, but it's there.
Now, if you notice the glow on the characters, you would think that this was shot at the Magic Hour. But all of the Magic Hour stuff shot for Tekken was literally shot during Magic Hour, and nothing got done because the amazing Jonathan hogged the spotlight.
Of course.
So it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate, but there's the film did so well that it recouped most of that magician budget.
Absolutely.
Now, going back to Mr. Hawkins,
yes.
Liam Neeson has become a superstar through the back door.
He has.
He has, but his sexual preferences notwithstanding, where do you think, what do you think makes him so compelling as an action hero, as a man over 40?
Well, I believe as a man over 40, I mean, his interest to the audience is that he is the everyman. He's the dour, interested party who has to deal with everything around him, but manages to keep his cool, whereas some other actors would go off the rails at times. He's always composed, and that sort of sets the tone for everyone who wants to be that ultimate badass.
Speaking of the ultimate badass, Maggie Grace here is wearing what they call a peasant top. And what that does is it accentuates the wrong shit on your body. And she rocks it. She pulls it off really well because she's obviously playing a much younger character than she is. Maggie Grace is 53 years old. Playing his daughter, talent. It's talent. Comes to the forefront. In Lost, she managed to play a survivor and the plane crash. She did a fantastic job in that. Here she is hugging her father, which once again reawakens his sexual predatory nature towards her.
Of course. When we start introducing the wolves that will threaten most of the characters in this plot, you'll really see that subtext start to pay off.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, one of his goals, I mean, Brian wants to bang. That's his goal. I mean, he's willing to go jump through any hoop, kill any terrorist in order to get to that fucking taint. But in the meantime, look at this performance he's giving. Look, he cares about his daughter. He's preparing her for the inevitable capture she will definitely receive. And he's handling it with such Maggie Grace.
Absolutely.
Now, this is a poor man's process in this shot. They're constantly running over the homeless.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, it's really outstanding work, which I think kind of brings us to the tragedy of how ignored this was around Oscar time. It did receive several nominations, it's true, for score, supporting actor, for The Horse. A few other, you know, random technical awards, that kind of best water sports sequence, that kind of thing. But didn't win any, actually, and it was largely ignored at the ceremony.
Surprisingly, it won the Preakness. And it didn't do well at Oscar time, but Liam Neeson excels at Burger Time. Which is trivia directly ripped from his IMDb page. Liam Neeson obviously
supposedly has something like 25 classic Burger Time cabinets in his home,
something like that, and he's been known to shout in the night, "It's Burger Time," irritating the Hollywood Hills.
Oh yeah,
and the people in it. The now as he drives his daughter to the airport, slang, they're discussing, you know, he's being a protective father because he wants to be the one to pop the shit out of that hymen. You know.
Oh, of course.
So he's very smart. Now this is the sacrificial best friend. The actress they got for this part was very late to the party. Alfre Woodard was supposed to play that role, and unfortunately there was a conflict. She was being completely ignored by casting agents right across town.
That map, by the way, drawn by Stephen Root.
Fantastic trivia. I didn't know that. This man with the salt and pepper colored hair, you may know him as a waiter at Boa Restaurant in Santa Monica. He also is the inventor of licorice.
Oh.
Which is surprising. Fomke returns. Here's what I question. He drove her to the airport. Why did they take two cars? Los Angeles. Why would you take two cars to the airport?
Well, I think that really drives in the wedge between these two and shows you the kind of chasm, the cavernous maw of hatred that exists between these two, and the sort of thing that will really pay off, or sets up the well-paid-off fuck-hate scene later in the film.
Yeah. Liam Neeson, some more trivia about him. His skin is so tough a beard can't exit the skin.
True,
he's got a massive beard just under the surface, which is why there's already a bounty for his head in most Nepalese countries. He's a stout man. If you've seen Excalibur or Rob Roy or his home videos, this guy is every bit a strapping dude. There's nothing fake about him. She's looking up to him. He's not on a box. He's standing on his own hands.
Absolutely. Yeah, and in fact, most of the scenes required everything else in the scene, cars, people, buildings, to be rebuilt on 2-foot stilts just to match heights with him. They considered getting a de-kneeing, as it's called. In the industry, it's something a few actors have chosen to do, but Neeson roundly rejected that, yeah. And hence the inflated budget.
Now, in the longer version of this scene, he gets a last jab to Fonke before they split up. He goes, "You cunt."
Yeah.
And they cut it out. They felt that might offend cunts.
Yeah.
Now, instead of actually filming in Paris, they showed a shot of Paris.
Absolutely.
But in actuality, this was all shot. I believe this was shot in Michigan?
Michigan.
Is this a Michigan film?
It was Michigan. It was indeed. I believe.
Flint. Which is kind of funny because Flint is a character from G.I. Joe.
Mm-hmm.
This man right here plays a very disposable man. He's a plot device.
Yep.
He's a non-player character. He provides some information, introduces the evil element, and then falls from a height, and then a vehicle gives him something.
Exactly. Johnny Foreshadowing, I believe his character's name is called. It's an odd choice.
Now, Mr. Hawkins, you've spent some time overseas. How real is the threat of a nubile American getting going on a sightseeing run and then getting fucked by life?
Oh, it's an absolute threat. I think any nubile American going through any kind of foreign territory needs to be on their guard every time, because once one is fucked, that's it. It's all over.
Yeah, that's true. That's very insightful. Now, one of the stipulations in Maggie Grace's rider and her contract, no bees. There's no bees allowed to be within a mile of her person.
This was an entirely bee-free set, which is very unusual for this kind of production. It took a lot of arrangement to make that happen.
Yeah, and I mean it's I mean obviously she was up for the Nicolas Cage role in The Wicker Man, and that fine print fucked her hard, man. It's a good thing that she's been able to rebound from that. She obviously appears as well in Tekken 2.
And it's arguable that she would not have gotten her place in this franchise had she not stuck to her guns in the other. And then she would just, you know, bees all over the place.
Yeah, right.
She can't have them.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a threat. Even the bees...
We have our first subtitles in the movie, which were actually drafted by ancient monks. So there's some real care went into those words.
Yeah, this is definitely a historical document. I mean, okay... Telltale sign that this is a red shirt. She's wearing Uggs.
Of course.
Yes.
One of the unwritten rules in film history, if you're wearing Uggs.
Which was a precedent established by the original Star Trek film, but just kind of a less noted.
Yeah.
Just indicates instant death.
Yeah, Ensign Ugg. I mean, if you remember Ensign Ugg in the third episode.
Absolutely.
He set the pace. Absolutely. Red shirt,
yep.
Furry boots, graveyard.
She's going nowhere good, and you can tell by her fucking footwear.
Now they're rocking out. Now, many bands were approached for the soundtrack of this film. Pierre Morel is a huge Neil Diamond fan. Neil Diamond was unavailable.
I believe they cut the scene to Coming to America.
Okay. That's news to me as well. And then, if I remember correctly, they also had Carrot Top provide a soundtrack just of clicks, grunts, and his own orgasm sounds.
Nice.
Which, actually, on the Blu-ray, you can listen to as an alternative comedy track.
It's great that they actually cut the Carrot Top soundtrack into Arthur and the Minimoys. So Luc Besson finally did get his out of this.
That's fantastic. Now, Liam Neeson is trying to call his daughter. If he would have just had a good daughter, this may have all been avoided.
Absolutely.
And Tekken would have been a sweet story about a family rekindling and a horse really kind of getting everything it had coming to it.
Now, this scene is where things get very tight and specific. The trailers were cut around this. This is the key sequence. So this is where Morel had his good pal, Gary Trudeau, the illustrator of the Doonesbury comic, to come in and very tightly storyboard this sequence, because every shot, every frame, every second matters in conveying the stress and terror of this particular scenario. So very great work from
the pants she's wearing are, some call them capris, some call them culottes. I call them penis shrivelers. Maggie Grace, this is one of the things they did to make her seem younger. Because, like I said, she's a virile woman. She's not a child. No. She has been entered and exited more than I care to mention.
Yeah, I mean, since her debut in the late 60s, you know, she's ridden different ways.
So these pants do a good job towards youthening her and euthanizing the hard-ons of the crowd, which is good because this scene needs to be all about terror. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, it's terrible.
Now, you'll see in this sequence evidence of just the raw difficulty of production. Trying to shoot this was very difficult because the different keys in the various departments accidentally hired a crew entirely comprised of reptiles. So other than a few specific department heads, there were no human beings operating equipment, moving lights, setting up production design, things like that. It was entirely... geckos and alligators, that sort of things, which is not, that's only been accomplished 3 times in Hollywood history, where a production is pulled through in that circumstance.
Also, the seminal character from Mortal Kombat was involved, which gave it a little bit more credibility and an attachment to Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, and trivia, his CGI has not improved, even a little bit, so.
Now, this scene obviously is famous, because this is the scene where we get to see the many uses of old cell phones. Maggie Grace is going to get taken.
Oh, yes.
Otherwise, the film wouldn't have been called Tekken. This is intense. This showcases how quickly Brian could become an assailant, a tough machine. He knows what clues to glean from her capture. This is textbook shit right here.
Absolutely. And they spent, I believe, something like 3 weeks rehearsing this phone call exchange between Neeson and Maggie Grace. Many dozens of drafts, and I believe the final take, they rolled something like 1 million feet of film between the two and really honed it down into something I would call biblical.
Yeah, and it's funny because like they shot a few scenes with Colin Farrell in a phone booth under the bed just to create that extended universe thing, and they just didn't fly with test audiences. They really got tired of seeing him. They thought Kiefer Sutherland's voice in the phone was forced. So they went back to Maggie Grace. Liam Neeson here is obviously very upset. Now, this is funny because they shot the scene. This is a reshoot. This was when he found out just how much his back end cut was. So right. You could see there's sweat on his brow, his hair is stringy, and you look at that. That is the look of consternation. He could give a fuck what his daughter's doing right now.
You know, it's actually interesting. He did ask about his character motivations during this role, and just like you said earlier, it was him being told, you're gleaning the clues, you're Christian Slater, you're sweating, you're troubled, do it.
Yeah, Pierre Morel is very much an obscure motivator. He pulls from weird places and then puts it into weird places, and that's his technique. That's why Luc Besson worships him.
Yeah, and you'll see the looks of terror, the sounds of terror. As we all know, this was the scene in which Pierre Morel had her literally murdered on the phone, and her appearances in all subsequent scenes and films has been entirely, of course, CGI.
And Andy Serkis.
Of course. And the early tributes to her are very touching, and the box office receipts, I think, for this film are a real testament to her dedication to this role. By being ripped to shreds and destroyed for this film.
Now, obviously, this film falls in line in a very lengthy series of muscular action films shot for a cost, and that's why you get an actor like Liam Neeson. You could not pull this off with a major Hollywood star like Brad Pitt or Michael Wincott or any of those kind of guys. You have to go with somebody who is fresh. Even though Liam Neeson has been everywhere all the time throughout every day, he's not what you consider a leading man in the same manner that George Clooney, Steve Buscemi, Michael Papajohn. It's just a completely different situation. So this was a coming of age, and right after this, you notice Hollywood greenlit tons and tons of action movies starring people that you wouldn't expect, like Live Free or Dangerous Strathairn. You had The Lethal Weapon. It hasn't been filmed yet, but you're doing The Lethal Weapon remake. And Danny Glover reprising his role. And then, of course, Jesus Christ, The Passion of the Christ.
Yeah.
So This is who's the guy that got to play Jesus in the remake?
I believe
Sean Combs. That's right, Puffy Combs.
Which was a long process to figure it out.
Yeah, which is also what they used on the set of WKRP in Cincinnati. So here we go. The daughter's been taken. That's fucked. That's over.
Really, this is the end of the movie as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I mean,
I've never watched past this point, so you gentlemen are going to have to lead me through this.
Well, basically, for the next hour, he rummages through her belongings.
I understand. That's
which is allegorical for what he really wants to do.
Of course.
Now, obviously, this is where we see the replacement father is a man of means, but he's not a man of action. So what the man of action does is he takes those means and buys another Burger Time cabinet.
Indeed. In fact, I do believe I've heard of the scene. They actually had to trim it down. For one take, he pushed forward that desk where a computer sits, and he pulled out a plug and plugged it back in and did that repeatedly for about 6 hours, and then demanded that that be included in the original cut. And it took weeks of negotiation to get that out of the film.
Now, you got to love a film that uses a lot of phones. I mean, we're looking at phones with cords, phones without cords. This is a telltale sign that this film was shot in 2000, like, what, 9?
Yeah, something like that.
Also,
it's really a mystery. No one actually knows. There's not a lot of recorded documents. So we've had to kind of piece things together from the evidence present in the film. But these fucking old phones do kind of give
now,
us...
Now, I'm going to ask you, as individuals, if you were a parent in Mr. Andrew Hawkins and your daughter was taken, how far would you go to retrieve her?
Well, I'm pretty sure I would go as far as I had to. Intergalactic distances, really, regardless. Although I would draw the line at interdimensional travel, just due to the fact that I am not physically conditioned for that as of yet.
How far if she had Down syndrome?
I would probably sit down in my chair, and that'd be about it.
All right, Mr. Brown, the same question to you.
Well, if my daughter was taken, I know I would first run a Google search, something along the lines of, where is my daughter? I'd click through the first couple of pages of results, and hopefully either that or the image search would give me some kind of clue. If not, I would go ahead and just watch a rewatch of the Seinfeld series, and likely masturbate.
Okay. These are the CinemaScore polled families leaving the theater, and they... basically the same answer. Now, Liam Neeson has already hopped a plane. I mean, let's face it. Brian sits on no laurels. Except on the plane he sat on.
He gets the fuck out there.
Yeah, he's there. And now he's in Detroit looking around. Now, Liam Neeson, we've seen him walk on a ledge in many films. But not quite like this. How he researched this was pretty interesting. He has Prince of Persia on his Mac.
Mm, yes.
Played it extensively. Pierre Morel shot this basically verbatim from the Commodore 64 version of the game. And I what a good job.
Yeah, I mean, the results are fantastic. That's a key moment in the film. Truly exciting stuff.
Now, let's talk about the controversy of Tekken. You know, there was a lot of picketing going on outside the theaters when this came out.
There was even some controversy on set that the protests were starting that early.
Okay. Now obviously it's a hot political topic. The theft of people.
Yes.
For some reason, throughout history, people have really not enjoyed being stolen.
Especially as in this film, when they're meant to, you know, be reduced purely to holes. Wet holes, but, you know, not exclusively.
Yeah, now here we're seeing a different perspective on the tragedy. Through a shaky camera, he is using his powers of mentalism to piece together what happened, which also feeds to the controversy. Now, Mr. Hawkins, when the film was about to be released, remember CNN did a lot of articles and news stories about this controversial film. They were basically saying it's the next Last Temptation of Christ. It's the next it's the next Blockade. It's the next Grease 2. It's gonna be incendiary. Here's Liam Neeson under the bed. How did you react? Did you want to see the movie more because it featured action, or because it was something that would stretch you as a fundamental Christian?
Well, honestly, it was really about the controversy. The fundamental Christian aspect of it wasn't really anything that I gravitated towards as much as the fact that I was living in Germany at the time, so I had to go and see it at the Kino Theater. And one of the significant things about the film was that certain scenes were cut by the Deutsche Republik because of their connections to telekinesis, and they don't believe in that. So I thought, why not? Let's do this. Let's watch it subtitled in German. Let's go.
I think it should be noted, the previous scene under the bed, it's one of the few that was so specifically storyboarded and shot that if you were to overlay the two scenes when Liam Neeson's under the bed and Maggie Grace is under the bed, their genitals line up and create a kind of a Rorschach test form that you can, you know, pull all kinds of different imagery out of. And also, this scene is very important, where he's rummaging through a conveniently broken cell phone to get this SD card, and then he slots it into, again, this is another place where Neeson, several hours of him slotting that piece in and out. He wanted that penetration subtext, and Morell and him fought on every day on set about
that.
Yeah,
I mean, he was very upset. What he originally wanted was to get an STD from his daughter. And he ended up just getting an SD. I think it still works, but I think the film does lack some of the menace it could have had. Now, here we see him zooming in. This is a reference to Blade Runner.
It is.
Brian James was unavailable for this film. So they did was they used Maggie Grace. Still works. And here, through the use of the digital means, he sees a villain. A lot of movies featuring Liam Neeson were in Excalibur. There's a scene where he's trying to figure out who ate his mutton. He goes into the king's chambers and zooms into an old painting, finds the mutton thief. So this is nice to see him revisit themes from previous films.
Absolutely. And originally that scene did take place in a Walmart at a Kodak-branded kiosk, but that clearance rights actually fell through, and that entire scene had to be, again, extensively CGI'd. And rebuilt.
Now here we see Liam Neeson pushing a man's face.
First of many.
Oh, absolutely. Now he's punching the man in the back seat, if you know what I mean.
We do.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
Now this is allegorical for the act of romantic gay sex. He kicks a man in the face and in the groin, which is also something that Liam Neeson takes great pride in.
And something that does happen often at this specific Paris airport.
Also, you'll note in classic films like The Godfather, symbology is used a lot. In that specific example, oranges are present in most scenes of death. Morell wanted to kind of emulate that a little bit, so in the Tekken series, death is always accompanied by a giant, massive erection scene at the front of Liam Neeson, so you should really watch out for that at the beginning of the film. Sometimes it's very subtle, but it's always evident.
This actor here is a method actor. He said, I want Tekken to be my last role. I would really like to do my own stunts. That's his khaki jacket. There's no set dressing, no costuming, nothing. Now, Liam Neeson's chasing him, even though earlier in that day he stubbed his toe on a plastic Marshmallow Man toy from Ghostbusters, continued to play his part because he's dedicated to his craft. That was a real stunt. That is a real zoom into Liam Neeson's face.
Yep,
that truck is real coming towards the man, but everything else in the scene is fake. Here we go. This is where he leaves the film.
And that indeed is one of the best parkour deaths since Punisher Warzone. Very significant.
Absolutely.
Yes, that was featured on Parkour and Recreation last season. Now, Liam Neeson is crestfallen. He had a lead. His lead is now wet on the ground, so he has to figure out the next course of action. And this is where the film really starts to unwind its bony fingers. This actor here is known as Francis Kevin Spacey.
He is?
Because he is also a closeted homosexual.
Yes.
Now, this stuff sets up Liam Neeson's character Brian's reach. This guy has seen everything, met everybody, and his tendrils reach out all over the place. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, he's fucked across the plains, across the world. He has deep hole contacts, and I think this is something we're going to see explored in hopefully Tekken 2 and Tekken 3.
If you watch Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, these scenes line up. There's a scene where where Mark Strong walks past an alleyway, this is what's happening outside that alleyway.
Absolutely.
It's fucking amazing how many films tie to this. Tekken is sort of like the Kevin Bacon of action films. If you have the opportunity to watch Ronin, which was filmed like over 12 years before this, there's a scene where Stellan Skarsgård exits a bathroom flicking a dingleberry. And if you look, this Kevin Spacey lookalike catches it, pockets it, and it shows up later in this film.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's something Morell has a deep-seated interest and lust for wormholes and that kind of space-faring theory. So the film is very subtly loaded with that, which has empowered him to run the DNA of so many action films into this film.
Now, this is the infamous receiving a business card scene that people have done productions in their high school of. It's something that's been... It's become one of those things.
There's been a long gestating Broadway attempt to get this scene kind of expanded. I'm not sure it's going to happen, but it's something they've been looking into for many years.
Yeah, here's your next subtitle, which is good to see.
Always.
Yeah. Now, as somebody who is a huge fan of subterfuge in filmmaking. What is it about Tekken that really speaks to you as a student of film, Mr. Hawkins?
Well, I think when we're talking about Tekken, the underlying subtext of pretty much everything that's going on is so significant when it comes to sexual tension and discovery of the individual that it's almost a learning experience and one that you can sort of mold your own life on. It's one of those films that really connects, and that's one of its greatest feats.
It should be noted that about 37% of the final production budget was actually spent licensing the typeface for those sequences in which brown people and foreigners speak their dumb languages and convert it into, of course, God's English. And that process was very costly.
It is. Now, if you sync up Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon with Tekken, this is the point in which you'll realize that was a huge mistake.
I think it's a much better mistake to probably sync up Primus's Pork Soda with this film, because here you really get the sense that Les Claypool does know how to play bass.
Now, this man here with Liam Neeson looks an awful lot like the lead singer of Men at Work after some hard years. He is not that man. This is just a character actor that Pierre Morel used in a previous film. This guy's claim to fame is that in addition to being a small part actor, he also is the guy who holds the patent on Patrick Stewart's muff.
Yes. Now we have the entrance of some ladies of the night. This is a sequence, not many people know this. It was included in a very rare pressing liner notes of the DVD, Best Buy Steelbox exclusive, but this does not work on mobile devices, so you need a pretty large TV to do this, but if during this scene you smash your dick against the screen repeatedly, you'll have a great time.
That's good to know. Whores are a big part of these films because they are disposable trim.
Much like Irreversible.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that goes hand in hand with a nice, gritty action film is the knowledge that no audience wants to see Brian go jackhammer himself to get the stress out. Right? I mean, like, there are scenes that were shot and removed from RoboCop where RoboCop has to go hammer one out because he is so taken aback by the amount of grief he is partaken of. No exception here. Brian is often pleasuring himself in this film, and I think the idea that he communicates with hookers tells us he knows that's a good place to drop a load in between assailants.
And I believe that's one of the reasons that many of these scenes were taken out of the German cut, because in fact he is actually having sex with these women using his telekinesis powers. And again, they don't believe in that.
Now, Liam Neeson is, this is the first time you see somebody kind of get the upper hand, but then you realize Brian is just trying to be submissive because some shit's about to go down. Watch.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a key scene. You really got to keep your eye out for the details and another very specifically storyboarded.
This is the, if you were lucky enough journalist to be invited to set, this is the weekend that they did the press visits. And off screen, Liam Neeson started what authorities called the most impressive Oreo fight they've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the reports on that were quite amusing to read.
Also, you know, to to help achieve the look of this film, Pierre Morel and his cinematographer watched Carbon Copy. They watched that, and they watched Mississippi Masala.
And Lee Clute as well.
They pieced the entire film together using those resources until the reshoots, when they completely forgotten that Mystic River has a sequence involving a cookie fight.
Absolutely. Keep your eyes out, because there's a few shots in here that needed to be replaced. So they're actually recreated entirely in stop motion. Henry Selick was brought in to advise. Very, very acute attention to detail, so they're hard to pick out, but just keep an eye out for
them. Yeah, there's a few scenes that don't come off quite as well, and that's because they had accidentally brought Tom Selleck. Yes. And he's just not really gifted in that way. Now, another interesting aspect of Tekken is that all throughout the production, they thought this film was a musical. In the editing room, they say films are discovered in the editing room. They realized they had forgotten to write songs.
Absolutely.
So I think what they did, they did a very good job of finding a way to grease up.
This is where you can see a cue the Winged Circuit cameo. He's actually perched in that building in that first shot.
That's knowledge. This is where the film kind of goes to shit, by the way. This is dog shit.
This is the Nikita part of the film. This is mainly driven by Luc Besson and very bad French techno electro.
Yeah, like. Too many people get killed here by Brian. I think a little bit goes a long way. I think Brian kills the entire shipyard.
It's pretty much true. The body count for the scene eclipses almost any other film that year.
Do you think that at any point in the production, Liam Neeson kind of realized that, oh my God, I've got to kick everybody's ass all this time. There's not a lot of drama here. This guy is. He chews dialogue like the fat
guy. Oh, yes.
What's this? What's going on here? Now, he's finding whores, right? He's finding girls that have been repurposed for the use of cum recipients, right?
Absolutely, and some character actors are actually sprinkled out through these rooms of fucking as well. So you just got to keep your eye out. There's some great ones.
Is this... Now, Marge Helgenberger is not in this particular sequence.
No. She was originally a negotiated cutout, maybe appearing in Tekken 2.
Okay. Now, he finds... This is a clue. He remembers his daughter was wearing this as she ran. The surprising element is he wasn't looking at the jacket when she ran away, in reality. So, if he would have found her pants, that would have been more telling.
Absolutely.
Here's a drugged whore. Not his daughter... So he wisely pops a load in her and moves on.
Yeah, absolutely. Although this is where we do start to see some real investigative prowess from Brian. He's great at like taking all the different pieces of the puzzle and putting them together, jamming them into places, putting them in himself, excreting them again, taking the juices and the processes and blending them together to get a real picture of what's happened in the world. And then again, he runs a Google search. Out where he needs to go to
yeah.
his daughter.
Now this is shot for shot from The Machinist right here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right up to that. Yep. And then it goes back into there, that's Tekken. This guy walks in, he tries to kill, but instead he shoots a girl right in the midsection. That's another character actress. She's no more.
Yeah, this is where it starts to get really exciting. We've got our first bits of gunplay. And now we've got our first bit of car chase, the promise of car chases, and the scale of the action really increasing. And where it just becomes complete shit.
A lot of windows were harmed in the set of this film. Some rights groups did speak out.
I think we really do get a feel for the tragedy of the cars in this scene. It's just waste, it's absolute abuse, and the vehicular slaughter in this sequence is just something that many tears have been shed over.
Yeah, the stunt coordinator for this movie was rapidly fattening Kathleen Turner, which was her first job in the business as a stunt coordinator. I think she pulled it off.
Absolutely.
Now, he's driving a Jeep. And that is allegorical, once again, for he's got a Q-Bert machine at home.
Yes, he doesn't play that nearly as much as Burger Time, but it does get some attention. I hear he's pretty solid at it.
Yeah, now these guys are trying to shoot him, and they suck at it.
Oh, they are failing. They are failing miserably. Many bullets are spent in this scene, and we get a sense of his almost invincibility.
Now, there's a guy that's not enjoying his afternoon.
At all.
Now,
this is, again, where a reptilian cast really made this difficult. So to accomplish this sequence, Neeson and his stunt crew choreographed this very complex car chase, and the production actually set up 467 separate cameras, and it was all done in one take.
Yeah, and the problem with shooting with lizards is they change color, so they had to go back in post and ethnicize some of these things, because the last thing you need is a purple black man. Yes. Now, here we go. Somebody's about to be grievously injured. That man did not enjoy it. And there's another guy. There's another guy that's really going to shit his pants. Do you understand?
It's very close to happening. Here we see that the pants were shit.
No, it's going to get worse for him before it gets better. Luckily, this came out before Ryan Dunn.
Now, here is where I like to reflect on Tango and Cash, because this is a scene that almost beat for beat gives credit to that. It's really something worth noting.
It's hard not to watch this film and just sit here and watch. He's gone! He is gone!
It is a rough ending.
An end of the day.
Few people know, interesting trivia, is the Tekken 2 has been directed by Olivier Megaton. He was actually caught on the periphery of set masturbating outside a chain link fence during the filming of this sequence.
Yeah.
Which is how he got his job. He actually came his resume into the sand at producer Luc Besson's feet.
Now, you know, it's a common principle in horror films using prosthetics where they'll hire amputees to play victims of hand choppings, leg choppings, face fuckings, all that kind of stuff. Tekken is no different. They use Vic Morrow as the driver of that car. He was already prepared. It's fantastic. Fantastic. You got to cut budget where you can. That's why they hired Liam Neeson instead of Charles Martin Smith. Here we go. He's got this drugged up cunt. He's putting her in the car. He's going to save her. He's going to make her day better. I think what this does is his fatherhood is not misspent. He's a paternal individual. He wants to protect. He wants to save. He preferred to get paid for it, but
he's a very fatherly figure for everyone except his daughter, who, of course, he just wants to fuck.
Yeah. And I would say he's almost a fatherly figure for the world in his humanitarian efforts. We really see how he really, truly cares about everyone across the board.
Now, he's at a house. He's visiting a man. He's leaving.
Unbelievable amounts of tension in the scene.
Now, I know that you're familiar with commentary tracks. More often, there's a lot more dead air, a lot less information. We feel your pain. There's nothing worse than watching a commentary track where people just say, remember that day on set? Oh, God. Yeah, remember we ate shrimp? Oh, fucking A. This girl's receiving a needle. Not the first time. She lives in Venice Beach, so let's just face it. Now, this is not medicine he's giving her. That is actually... Let's see the label. Yep, it's Fresca. He's putting Fresca into this person.
Yes, and there was some high and mighty controversy about that, and a lot of articles written about the chemical and scientific implications of what this movie was, you know, telling people about rescuing sloppy, disgusting human beings from prostitution rings.
Now, this pallid, comatose, boring lady... was hired for a song, which is good, because if this were a Tim Burton film, that would have been Helena Bonham Carter.
Always. Every time. And the song that she's actually hired for is I Like Fresca in My Veins, which really goes well with this scene, but sadly wound up making the cut.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can catch it on the B-side, oddly, of the Transporter 3 soundtrack.
Not a fan of B-sides, Maggie Grace. Now, Liam Neeson is crestfallen here. He's starting to sink in that he's been running around the country since the beginning of the film.
This is not in the script. This is Liam Neeson's actual phone ringing and him getting a call. It was very rude. We should all be offended.
Yeah. Now, here's talking to the Kevin Spacey. See, he doesn't get fucked by anyone. He knows what's going on. He's always six steps ahead. Which is fantastic. It makes you really understand why you should really kidnap the daughters of losers. I mean, if I was a kidnapper, I mean, this is the last guy I would steal. I'd steal Michael J. Fox's daughter or something.
I think that'd be a much safer bet. I think on the priorities list, you really do not want to cross Liam Neeson, because as this film plays out in the overall, he truly is the one who does the fucking. Yeah. So you have to consider that.
Plus, I mean, this actually, there was rival films in production. There was one with Michael J. Fox, it was called Shaken.
Yes.
Now, this is where, like, this is where the European origin of this film really shines through. Because they're not texting. They're having a man's conversation. Uh-oh. Do you see the wind blows the way it blows his hair?
Yeah,
is that symbolic?
It's very delicate work. The subtext of that, you know, it could mean a lot of things. The composition of the scene obviously did not allow for his just enormous, monstrous erection to be composed. So the flapping hair was a way of kind of evoking a similar sentiment that he has a raging heart on.
He descends, and that is an homage to the movie The Descent.
Oh, yes.
Now, here's the scene where he enjoys a drink and reads a novel. Probably a bad idea while your daughter is being raped.
Yeah, that was actually a shot taken by the EPK crew as just a behind-the-scenes cute moment. But Morell liked the idea that he is so completely uninvested in this shitty woman.
Is it funny that this lady at her sickest looks like Kristen Stewart at her best?
Absolutely. I think that has a lot to say about American pop culture.
She looks like Kristen Stewart.
She does.
Now, he's showing a photograph. He's saying, have you seen this girl? Have you seen this girl? Have you seen this girl? But it's not even a picture of his daughter. He's just a huge fan of that fucking prostitute. Whoa, what the fuck? What the? Whoa, she's flashbacking. I don't remember this element.
Well, this is the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory scene where we sort of get a look of how he is related to Gene Wilder's character in the film, as noted. And once we get past that, we realize that everyone is indeed on acid at this point.
It's funny that Charlie the Chocolate Factory, this actress cannot get enough of being in movies with Charlie in the title. She was in the adult industry, and she was one of the three Charlie's Angels. And she did a fantastic job.
That really set her up on the scene, I think. That got her noticed and kind of paved the way.
That's certainly why Liam knows about her.
This extended scene here that we're seeing in which she's flashing back and everything, this is actually, I would call, residue or just kind of a latent characteristics of this script. This was actually written originally as a very gritty, realistic, post-Nolan Yellow Submarine reboot. And then Neeson got his hands on the script. Morell caught on wind of it, and it was rewritten as the amazing thriller that it is. But so you're kind of seeing a little bit of that left over.
This guy knows. This guy knows something's afoot because he introduced himself as Oscar Schindler, which is kind of funny because there's a recurring theme in Liam Neeson's career. Where he's minding his own business, and then he's required to save lives.
Yes.
Oftentimes against his will.
Absolutely.
Oftentimes from a list.
And I believe this scene was actually cut originally to the music of Franz Liszt, so the connection to Oscar Schindler is even more prominent.
This man won't get another job looking like that.
No, this is about all he was well suited for.
Now, this shot, this was actually not shot in Michigan. They actually built a set on the Mir space station just for this sequence here. That's why the budget skyrocketed.
Absolutely.
Literally.
You could see the way zero G's affects Liam Neeson's nostrils here.
Indeed. They did it because they were involving a lot of actors with severe medical issues that needed to they needed a place where they could be in stasis while they performed. But unfortunately, the production caused so much damage, and that is why Mir had to be decommissioned and ultimately crashed into the sea.
Yeah. This was another one that was originally conceived as a musical number. Because if you notice, he sips the coffee. There's a very musical balance to the way that this is edited. You follow his coffee cup through the scene. And this song was actually going to be performed by his coffee. And it would have been so much better, I think. This is now it comes off as just let's visit some Eurotrash. But it really had some meat in its original concept.
Absolutely. This is a scene of delicate interplay, subtle suggestions. The performance of this scene took weeks to hone.
Love that smile. Those eyes, those Irish eyes are smiling. This guy is known as the Scandinavian John Cazale, right up to the fact that he died shortly after the making of this film.
Yes. And in kind of a almost tragic mirror of John Cazale, he was actually involved only in absolute utter shit films.
Yeah, do you think Liam Neeson...
Four stinkers in a row.
Do you think Liam Neeson, Mr. Hawkins, chose the right outfit for this sequence? I don't like Brian in a tie.
Brian in a tie doesn't really seem to fit properly. I think he tries to be the different kind of person that he is on his normal mission in this scene. He tends to...
Guest appearance by Bjork.
Be a little more free, a little more at ease when he is kicking ass. But here he seems more constrained, making him less of a threat than what he would normally be, putting him below these in his surroundings. And then when the tie comes off, it's back to game time.
Yeah, that's allegorical too. Yeah, it's about this part in the film where we're roughly an hour into the movie. It needs to take a break. It's been nonstop kicking everybody's ass and talking on the phone. So now we're just kind of taking a breather. You know something's going to go down very soon. He's starting to flashback. This guy doesn't shave. Things are going to get fucked. Oh, and now he's putting two and two together. The voice he heard on the phone was this man's voice.
Details are starting to kind of really clarify and wrap together. We're seeing some of the momentum, delicate subtext set up earlier being paid off here. This is filmmaking.
Is he going to fuck an entire room full of men?
Of course, absolutely. That table stunt, again, weeks of preparation. Originally, you may have heard of a horror film tradition in which different directors like Wes Craven and have attributed, in kind of a playful way, other horror films by having torn posters appear on the wall, kind of suggesting that their film is perhaps scarier than the one that preceded it. This film, this sequence, I think we're past it now. You might want to rewind it back and take a look. There's actually a torn glitter poster on the wall, which also has the dual purpose of at one point Mariah Carey was set to appear as the horror seen earlier, dried up, cantankerous, but that did not work out. Her quote was too high, but it was too late to remove the poster from the scene.
See, this is annoying because look at all the horrors he's ignoring.
Horror-noring.
Yeah, I mean, did he find what he thinks he found? He looks...
It's got to be her. Oh, it is not. It is, in fact, Kristen Stewart again.
I guess every girl looks like Kristen Stewart.
I believe at this point is...
Now, let's face it. We may be due for another flashback here because audiences may not remember that this is the bitch that she was traveling with. This is her travel bitch. This is the girl who was first accosted. She is no more. They have drugged her into a death. And that tells you that his daughter could be next. This obviously motivates him.
It's truly difficult to even hazard a guess at how many foreign juices are flowing through, around, in, about this poor woman.
Yeah, I mean, like...
But Neeson can sniff them all. Don't you worry. He knows every chemical in her. And he's ready to exact some justice.
I mean, tapping a captured ass is not unlike swishing around a sample of a new bottle of wine. It's got legs and that it works.
Very true.
Very rarely does a chef send his dish out of the kitchen having not tasted it. So that girl, let's put it this way, the autopsy is going to find about 250 million things. This is the interrogation scene ripped directly from the same exact shot-for-shot scene in 16 Candles.
you can tell this is where the scene or the film really starts to unleash some of its headier subtext of male American repression and impotent father figures finally being allowed to really tear new assholes of the boyfriends that are just fucking beautiful young daughters left and right. This is where it really starts to let it all out.
This guy's about to... He's crying. Not because he's losing this battle, but because he's losing to a man named Brian. And that's got to be demoralizing.
Absolutely.
Now, Mr. Hawkins, describe to us your initial feelings upon leaving the theater having seen Tekken.
Well, once I saw Tekken, I thought it was a very satisfying film. It was one that would definitely resonate with the culture globally. And it immediately required a sequel. But in regards to the main character, Brian, I think that it was an excellent, excellent sequel to The Life of Brian.
This guy has been electrocuted.
Something fierce.
He is, he knows what it's like to be hit in the face with a gun. This guy, first of all, a makeshift electric chair is something that's not used enough in film. And secondly, the allegory of emptying and stuffing a man's mouth with cloth has been written about by smarter men than myself. But you gotta wonder what that thing smelled like at the end of the day.
Yeah, and a lot of people were upset by the scene, the mistreatment. It was kind of overseen by the Humane Society. This European cock was, you know, fully treated well and humanely and killed and roasted and eaten by the crew after the scene. So this is not just, you know, superfluous, fragrant abuse, and, yeah. You know.
And that's why Vince Neil looks like he's put on some weight.
Absolutely.
Now here we reach a sequence in the film once he disposes of this man. If I remember right, I think he leaves him roasting. There, he's out of here.
I believe that's much like Brian James in Horror Show or House 4, as it were.
Yes. Now, Kevin Spacey's coming home. This is one of my favorite moments in the film. I'm a sucker for baguettes. When a man has a baguette in his hand, it begets something else in the scene, and it's pretty interesting. This is the infamous "the chicken smells great" sequence, and look who's here, Brian. Now, I think they proved once again in White Hunter Black Heart that if you're not getting what you want, the wife has to feel it.
Absolutely.
This scene illustrates such.
Absolutely, and this is the scene that really touched off a lot of controversy as well, a lot of moral ambiguity and, you know, things about torture and what lengths will a man go to and these sort of things. They're all kind of come to a point in this scene. So, you know, a lot of protest and anger over, you know, why would he choose a shirt of that color?
Yeah. Now, this is funny because on the set, Liam Neeson was playing a joke. Whenever he was... not on camera, when he was just, you know, they were responding to him, he kept saying, "How wet's your beaver? How wet's your beaver?" to every character. And it became like a running joke. As a matter of fact, the crew all has a shirt that says, "Tekken, how wet's your beaver?" And finally, at the end of the shoot, she responded, "Pretty wet."
Yep.
She's got a wet one. At least, you know, being in this magical film. They're eating dinner, but the Kevin Spacey knows Brian has got an agenda.
Yeah, originally, the scene was going to revolve around kind of a Solo referencing Feast of Shit, in which entirely feces-related dishes were being served, but that was just a little too transgressive for American audiences. So again, it's another post-production modification that you can find some rare European copies. You can see how it was originally intended.
Yeah, and that's why they cut the Natasha Henstridge cameo out of the film.
Oh, yeah.
Because that would have directly tied to Species, and it would have...
Nobody wants that.
Nobody really did. This guy's infuriated. Now, here's an interesting bit of trivia. This was filmed on sets that they didn't strike from Lonesome Dove.
Oh, interesting. I had no idea. That's new to me.
He's got the gun on Liam. You're like, has our hero finally met his match?
But then, of course, we have the dramatic bullets on the table scene. He hurls them at him, Neeson was actually hoping to murder this person by hurling those bullets.
There's the wife getting shot.
And there we have it.
Is that too soft of a response for when your wife gets shot? He calls him an asshole.
Yeah, I mean, you would think the language would be a little stronger, but...
Yep, this is one of the go-tos.
That said,
nothing triggers data entry like a wife shooting.
Absolutely. I do believe French Kevin Spacey, he was trying to hide a little bit of excitement, you know, in his wife. Canon of the Tekken series have been married for a long time. There's, of course, a prequel graphic novel explaining how their marriage has gone a little soft and sour. So the prospect of a new hole, definitely exciting for him.
Yeah, and 22 sounds about right.
Yeah.
Now, here we go. We enter the sequence of the film inspired by Babe Pig in the City, where people auction off other people.
Right.
Now, once again, Brian is observing. He's just an observer. He's getting ready.
Perhaps even making a few purchases off screen.
Yeah, that's a good call. I mean, he does have access to the lucrative Xander Berkeley allotment.
And this was shot in an actual cunny auction. So, you know, what you're seeing here is very real things. They had to kind of ingratiate themselves into the society to pull this off. A lot of difficult permits were obtained because this is all pretty real stuff.
Accompanying them on the set, too, was the karaoke machine he bought for his daughter at the beginning. Liam Neeson would often regale crew members with a very misty-eyed performance of Master of Puppets. Also, his crooning Irish brogue lent a very nice timbre to a variety of different songs from the Hoodoo Gurus, Jesus and Mary Chain, and most famously, which will be on the sequel to Duets, Liam Neeson sings the work of Sheryl Crow. His voice perfectly matches Sheryl Crow. Maggie Grace would constantly do a-ha songs. Famke Johnson was above karaoke. Xander Berkeley, funnily enough, did the Lucky Charms theme, which was not even available in karaoke until this movie was made. So good for us.
If I remember right, I believe John Grise did an incredible rendition of Hot by Squirrel Nut Zippers.
Speaking of, Liam Neeson is now entering the viewing chamber of human sales. Now, this kind of stuff really happens. What I didn't realize was that it's really happening right now in this house.
Yes.
We're recording this on a sabbatical in the beach, and literally bodies are being rented beneath us as we speak. Now, this actor here who plays the waiter is no longer in the film.
Not at all.
This man is not rewarded for a ponytail.
As no man should be, I mean, frankly. I think Morell, he shaped that scene very carefully, and some of his true feelings are out. Now we got some TNA. This is the film's most sensual sequence, in my personal opinion.
This is, I think this is, this woman is for sale. Obviously, they didn't starve this one. Ren, if you had the resources and were able to buy a woman like this, what characteristics would you go for?
Frankly, I mean, we're getting into some personal things here, but I appreciate very bark-like skin. Hair, I prefer to be some kind of, you know, natural hue. No blondes, necessarily, but a nice rocky color. And really, anything that has multiple crevices. I'm a man of options. I like choices. I don't want to be restricted to just one point of entry. So, you know, anything, object, person, dog, creature, woman, that fulfills those requirements, I'd probably be pretty interested in paying a pretty high price for.
Same question to myself. I like to fuck a woman from an isometric perspective. So there's really only one angle that really matters to me. It's sort of a cockeyed adjacent glimpse, preferably from the side. If it's tight, I'm in. That's the thing. I won't spend anything less than the market value for a woman who I can inhale from a distance. Maggie Grace has surfaced once again, so he's found his daughter. She is for sale. which does make us think that maybe this trip is worth it for Brian.
Now, of course, again, we're getting into the American male subtext. Of course, we find out that because this daughter is a virgin, she's going to fetch a particularly high price, and that the bidding war will escalate far more. So, again, we have a very self-aggrandizing subtext as this man's daughter is both untouched but completely desirable, but only he can save her. And fuck the Jesus out of her.
Yeah, I don't like the fact that Morrell's let the normal subtlety of this movie take a lapse when the villain was waiting outside the terminal of Virgin Airlines. Yeah. Kind of cut through the chase a little bit. Mr. Hawkins, the same question to you. If you were in the buying a piece of sniz business, what would you be aiming for?
Well, when I'm typically looking for the cash, I'm trying to usually use my typical interest of being a fan of Classic Nukem High Part 2. My first thing that I always look for is a fully functioning oral orifice on the stomach. If it can talk to me and not resemble a belly button anyway, I'm sold.
That's good. That's a good point. Now,
which would explain your long affair with James Woods in the early 90s.
Yes, absolutely. And I like guns.
A similarity between both Liam Neeson and James Woods is that they are a member of the allegorical hung jury in Hollywood, men with large penises. James Woods, unfortunately, has a fantastically huge penis, but a face that looks like the Mars rover needs to visit it. Liam Neeson is a striking man, gifted with talent, height, and a goddamn penis. He's the perfect like mixture of skills for Hollywood, able to function in front of and behind the scenes. There are many people who have been conquests over the course of Liam Neeson's Dick's career. Before his sad Natasha death, he gave Sandra Bullock everything he owned. He put Emma Thompson underneath him. He's fucked quite a few, and that's not including Larry Drake.
Now, if you'll remember, this is the sequence, the film, if you watched it during its original run, you'll remember that it was presented in Spree-D, which was just a shameless corporate tie-in, and this is the point in the movie where every theater showing, midnight showing, was given a dose of candy to accentuate the action in the scene. It's a very out-of-place, odd, promotional thing, but when your budget, you know, creeps up past the $780 million mark, those are the kinds of deals that the devil you have to make.
And let's face it, these guys aren't that surprised to hear a gunshot. That shit happens all the time.
Yeah, European men bust like rockets, and there's a lot of ejaculation going on.